says Israel's repeated attacks on Gazans waiting for aid prove that the regime seeks to deepen the humanitarian crisis in the besieged territory. The United Nations Children's Fund warns that many more children in Gaza will die of dehydration and malnutrition unless obstacles to providing aid are removed. And Iraq's Islamic Resistance says it has launched a drone attack on a chemical facility in the Israeli port of Haifa in support of Gaza. Hello everyone, thank you for joining us. Now, Palestinian resistance movements have denounced Israel for carrying out yet another deadly attack on a crowd of Palestinians waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. Hamas says the attack proves that Israel is pushing ahead with this genocidal war on Gaza. It added that Israel wants to deepen the humanitarian crisis in the besieged territory with this systematic use of starvation against Palestinians. In a separate statement, the Islamic Jihad says the attack is another proof of the regime's criminal nature. It called on the Arab and Muslim countries to take actions to stop Israel's massacre of Palestinians. Israeli forces on Sunday shelled hundreds of Palestinian aid seekers who had gathered near the Kuwaiti roundabout in Gaza. The shelling killed 9 Palestinians and injured dozens more. Over 100 Palestinians were killed on Thursday after Israeli troops opened fire at people waiting for food aid in Gaza City. The United Nations Children's Fund has warned that many more children in Gaza will die of dehydration and malnutrition unless there is direct intervention to provide assistance. UNICEF's regional director, Adel Khodr, added that these tragic deaths are man-made, predictable, and entirely preventable. She said a lack of nutritious food, clean water, and medical services is a direct consequence of preventing aid supplies to Gaza. She demanded aid agencies be allowed to bring in relief assistance through all possible crossings. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food called for sanctions against Israel, saying this is the only way to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. Michael Fakhri added, a famine is looming in Gaza as Tel Aviv is intentionally starving Palestinians there. Earlier we spoke to our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh in Deir al-Balah. He told us that Israel hasn't stopped its attacks on humanitarian aid trucks in the besieged strip. Let's take a listen.
Over the last couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes renewed their attacks against the northern part of Gaza Strip. Several residential buildings were destroyed, particularly in the eastern part of Jabalia refugee camp and Beit Lahia town in the far north of Gaza Strip. As a result of these continuous attacks and airstrikes hitting several areas of Gaza Strip, 31 Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed as a result of the Israeli airstrikes in Rafah over the last night. We are in front of continuous Israeli airstrikes, and according to the UN, that the Palestinian children here in Gaza are dying slowly before the eyes of the whole world. This reflects how catastrophic the humanitarian conditions are, because the people here, particularly the Palestinian children, are living catastrophic humanitarian conditions. They are completely deprived of their basic humanitarian supplies, particularly milk, food, and drinkable water, leaving them suffering amid an unprecedented situation. They are suffering from the dehydration and the malnutrition, which threatens the lives of thousands of the Palestinian children here in Gaza Strip. In the meantime, the European Mediterranean Center for Human Rights actually announced that they have documented dozens of the cases of the Israeli tanks running over the Palestinian dead bodies, particularly in the western part of Khan Yunis city. They have documented dozens of the Palestinian civilians squashed under the chains of the Israeli tanks while they were attacking those residential areas, while they were attacking the tents taking shelter by the Palestinian evacuees in Khan Yunis and elsewhere in Gaza Strip.
The Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it has attacked the Israeli port of Haifa in the occupied territories in support of the Palestinian people in Gaza. The Iraqi Resistance says it targeted a chemical facility in the port with a drone. It added that the operation was carried out in response to Israel's massacre of Palestinian civilians, including women and children, in Gaza. The Islamic Resistance in Iraq has carried out a number of attacks on Israeli targets in recent months. The group has also struck major American military bases in Syria and Iraq amid anger over the US support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. A European NGO says Israeli tanks have deliberately run over dozens of Palestinians in separate incidents across Gaza. The Euromed Human Rights Monitor said a young Palestinian man lost his life after the regime's forces ran over him in Al Zaytun district in Gaza City on Thursday. The Geneva-based NGO cited similar other incidents that have taken place in different areas of the besieged territory in recent weeks. It also confirmed that Israeli forces destroyed civilian property, especially vehicles, during their ground assaults on various areas of Gaza. The Euromed noted that the regime's troops have caused such destruction with no necessity or justification. The US redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group has had little effect other than worsening the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is already in critical condition. Abdul Latif Abu Shali reports from Sana'a.
A series of restrictions were imposed on the Yemeni economy following the U.S. redesignation of the Ansarullah movement as a terrorist group earlier this year. This blacklisting has had an impact on the humanitarian situation in the war-torn country, where millions of people are in dire need of aid.
Ansarullah as a political component has no external economic relations or companies in the private sector that have real weight in the national economy. The real goal of the resolution is to blackmail Ansarullah and distort their position in support of Gaza. The Yemeni economy has been in a state of siege for 9 years, and therefore the American measures putting pressure on the local economy we believe will not have much effect, especially since the Yemeni economy has withstood pressure over the past years and adapted to the measures imposed by the exiled Yemeni government in Riyadh. The Central Bank of Yemen will also work to impose procedures to secure the transfer of foreign exchange to and from Yemen.
Several international companies, including the money transfer company Western Union, have suspended their activities in Yemen, severely affecting the livelihoods of most Yemenis who rely on financial support from relatives abroad. Experts predict that such actions will lead to the creation of a black market for those benefiting from the suspension of money transfers.
The United States of America imposed collective punishment on the Yemeni people. Very important financial channels were stopped, such as Western Union, which is one of the most important money transfer networks in the world, and through it, Yemeni expatriates in American and European countries used to send money to their families in Yemen easily. We have 6 million expatriates outside the country and thousands of Yemeni families depend on them to provide a living. You can imagine what the situation will become after these financial transfers stop. The beneficiaries of this measure are black market workers who exploit these circumstances by deducing a percentage of their remittances and transfer them through illegal channels.
In an effort to deter Yemen's naval operations against vessels linked to the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, the U.S. Department of State blacklisted the Ansarullah movement as a specially designated global terrorist group. However, this designation has primarily affected the humanitarian situation, as members of the Ansarullah movement have no investments abroad.
Observers believe that Washington's recent measures are aimed at inciting the Yemeni people to take to the streets in opposition to the Ansarullah movement as a strategic move to undermine the group's popularity in the country. But that plot does not look like it will succeed, given the widespread support for Ansarullah in Yemen.
A visit by Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz to the U.S. to discuss a ceasefire in Gaza has infuriated Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. We have discussed the significance of the deepening political rift in Israel with our guests. Let's take a listen.
Time now for the news review. A planned visit to the U.S. by Israeli War Cabinet Minister Benny Gantz has enraged Prime Minister Netanyahu. Gantz, who is Netanyahu's main political rival, is to meet with U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris and other senior American officials on his trip. That has left Netanyahu infuriated, as he has not authorized the trip. In a phone conversation with Gantz, he told him sarcastically that Israel has only one prime minister. Netanyahu was even said to have been unaware of the visit until Gantz called him on Friday to let him know of his plans and to discuss what messages to convey to the Americans. Now, let me invite two guests to get their insight on this and discuss that a bit. So John Stepling, author and commentator, is joining me from Indre, Norway, and Robert Fantina, author and journalist from Kitchener, Ontario. Good to see you both, gentlemen. Now, John, beginning with you, why should Benny Gantz want to go to the U.S. without letting the Prime Minister know about this in the first place?
Well, I mean, this assumes that we take this story at face value. Biden has an election coming up, and in the primaries, the protest vote has been massive because people are infuriated with the genocide taking place, with his positions on Gaza, his facilitating this genocide, as has the entire political class in the U.S. So he has to be seen to be making noises about, well, we're going to airdrop relief aid and food in there. We're going to do this and that. He's not stopping anything. He's not stopping the slaughter, and he could do that very easily. This is political theater. Benny Gantz is going to meet Kamala Harris, probably the least important person he could possibly meet in Washington. I mean, I guess he could meet the dog catcher, but that's about it. Jake Sullivan is said to maybe have a meeting with him. Sullivan came up as deputy secretary for Hillary Clinton. He is a hardline pro-Zionist, one of the major supporters of the Zionist project that exists in Washington. Blinken too is another, you know, rabid Zionist supporter, and I don't think Blinken is even going to meet with Gantz. But they came out of the same political milieu, you know, maybe Gantz and Netanyahu didn't communicate. Maybe Netanyahu is actually really angry. It doesn't matter, because this is a distraction. Ultimately, nobody is saying we are going to stop this genocide. The U.S. is doing actually nothing. People are, children, infants are starving in hospitals, and nobody is doing anything to get the food to them. So this becomes a distraction. I think it's probably more about the upcoming election in the U.S. than it is anything else.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's see what Robert thinks about it. Robert, what's the purpose of this visit? What messages could there be conveyed? And is Gantz trying to, in a way, because he's the main rival of Netanyahu, is he maybe trying to pave the way for replacing him or something?
Yes, I think he certainly is. As you said, he's the main rival. He would like to be a prime minister. Netanyahu is in a very precarious position as far as his position as prime minister of Israel. He's extremely unpopular. He's unpopular because of his corruption, because of the hostage situation. There are some pockets of Israel that find him unpopular because of the genocide, although those are limited. And as far as Benny Gantz coming to the United States, this doesn't signal any major change in U.S. policy. He opposes a two-state solution. He wants to expand the illegal settlements. He does not want to give equal rights to the Palestinian people in either the occupied territories or in so-called Israel proper. So this is Biden basically making a personal insult to Netanyahu, but it doesn't change anything as far as the direction of Israeli governance. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't signal a change to the U.S.'s position on the occupation, which it has supported and financed for decades. So it is, as your other commentator said, it's political theater, and it is, as I mentioned, kind of a personal slap in the face to Netanyahu by Biden. But as far as any meaningful change that's going to come out of this, there isn't any.
Okay. I appreciate your comments. John Stepling from Indre and Robert Fantina from Kitchener, Ontario.
Iran's president has called on the International Court of Justice to stop the Israeli genocide in Gaza by delivering a guilty verdict against the regime as soon as possible. Ibrahim Raisi says the sentence in South Africa's genocide case against the regime will also bring an end to Israeli occupation and lead to the trial of the regime's leaders and its allies. Raisi made the remarks in a press conference with the Algerian president following their meeting in Algiers. He said Iran and Algeria both support the rights of the Palestinian people and oppose Israeli occupation and crimes. The Iranian president said the hands of the US and some other Western countries are stained with the blood of the people of Gaza. Raisi, however, expressed confidence that Palestinians would prevail against Israel and its allies. For his part, Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune hailed Iran's position on the issue of Palestine and slammed the silence of some countries on the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Vote counting is underway in Iran for two major elections that were held on Friday. The polls will determine the fate of the next parliament and the assembly of experts. According to officials, more than 15,000 nominees competed in Friday's elections, and over 40% of those eligible for voting participated in the elections. Our correspondent Gisu Misha Ahmadi was at the Ministry of Interior for the updates.
As far as vote counting is concerned, the fate of 230 seats of the parliament, the 290 seats, 230 of them are now decided, but for the rest of them, we might have to go to a second round of elections, maybe later in April. We don't know exactly how this is going to play out, and that is why we are waiting for a very important press conference that will take place tomorrow, 8 a.m. local time. The Interior Minister himself will be talking to reporters and taking questions about what is going to happen next. Well, in some of those small constituencies which only have one or two seats in the parliament, the fate of those seats have already been determined. We know that less than a handful of them now will be going to the next round for sure. But right now, at this moment, we have all our eyes on the big provinces and the big constituencies, most importantly Tehran constituency, which will definitely determine the landscape, the political landscape of the Iranian parliament in its 12th term. And this is why everyone is waiting for those final results. Behrouz, we do know that some of the heavyweights, such as Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, and who is actually right now the parliament speaker, Mr. Nabavian, are among those that have gained many votes, and they are definitely going into the parliament. There's also the former foreign minister of Iran, Manoucher Mottaki, another well-known politician that will be entering the parliament. But in order to draw a landscape, we're going to have to wait for those final results.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio. The limelight. France's President Emmanuel Macron wanted to create strategic ambiguity by openly discussing the idea of sending Western troops to Ukraine. but he was so ambiguous that he sparked confusion and irritation among some of France's allies. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. France's national broadcaster France 24, France 24, has covered this story and tells us more. French President Emmanuel Macron faced uneasy reactions from European allies and a warning from the Kremlin on Tuesday, 27th of February, after he refused to rule out the dispatch of Western ground troops to Ukraine in its fight against Russia. President Macron said after a conference of European leaders on Monday, 26th of February, that everything that is necessary must be done to ensure the defeat of Russia, including deploying troops on the ground in Ukraine. The Kremlin warned of the inevitability of confrontation between NATO and Russia if troops from the NATO alliance were deployed in the conflict, which would break a major taboo the West has so far been reluctant to challenge. Emmanuel Macron hosted the conference just over 2 days to the day after the Ukraine-Russia war started, seeking to rally greater support for Kiev, which faces increasing battlefield challenges and dwindling munitions stocks. He painted a grim picture of Russia under President Vladimir Putin, arguing there had been a change of posture even in recent months that had seen a hardening of Russia's stance both domestically and in Ukraine. While there was no consensus on the sending of Western ground troops to Ukraine, nothing should be ruled out, Macron said. We will do whatever it takes to ensure that Russia cannot win this war, Macron added. Emmanuel Macron had refused to say more about France's position, citing the need for strategic ambiguity, but saying the issue was mentioned among the options. We are convinced that the defeat of Russia is indispensable to security and stability in Europe, Emmanuel Macron said. Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico said after the meeting that there was disunity on the issue among European leaders. There are countries that are ready to send their own soldiers to Ukraine. There are countries that say they will never do that, and Slovakia is among them. And there are countries that say that this proposal should be considered. Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson of Sweden, which is set to join NATO, poured cold water on Macron's idea, saying it's not on the cards at all for the moment. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz said in a tetchy message on X, formerly known as Twitter, "We agreed that everyone must do more for Ukraine in Paris yesterday. Ukraine needs weapons, ammunition and air defense. We're working on it. It is clear there will be no ground troops from European countries or NATO fighting in Ukraine." Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said that if NATO troops appeared in Ukraine, we would need to speak not about a possibility, but of the inevitability of confrontation. "This is absolutely not in the interests of these countries. They should be aware of this," Dmitry Peskov added. A NATO official who spoke on condition of anonymity emphasized there are no plans for NATO combat troops on the ground in Ukraine, despite the unprecedented military support from the NATO alliance for Kiev. The Italian government said support for Ukraine did not include sending troops. "When we talk about sending troops, we must be very cautious, because we must not make people think that we are at war with Russia," said Italian Foreign Minister Antonio Tajani. "We are not at war with Russia," Tajani emphasized. Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. French President Emmanuel Macron wanted to create strategic ambiguity by openly discussing the idea of sending Western troops to Ukraine, but it was so ambiguous that it sparked confusion and irritation among some of France's allies. Emmanuel Macron's comments at a late-night news conference after he hosted a meeting of Western leaders to rally support for Ukraine fitted with his reputation as a diplomatic disruptor who likes to break taboos and challenge conventional thinking. By declining on Monday night, 26th of February, to rule out putting Western boots on the ground in Ukraine, Emmanuel Macron was challenging the prevailing view that such a move would gravely escalate the risk of a global war between NATO and Russia. His comments may turn out to be prescient and pave the way for greater direct Western involvement in the Ukraine war. But they also run the risk of undermining the very thing that Emmanuel Macron sought to bolster with the Paris meeting, unity among Ukraine's Western allies, as Kiev's forces struggle to hold off Russian troops 2 years into the war. The White House declared it would not send troops to Ukraine. Germany, Britain, Italy, Spain, Poland, and the Czech Republic, also all of them, swiftly distanced themselves from Emmanuel Macron's idea. The Kremlin, meanwhile, said such a move would make a direct conflict between NATO and Russia inevitable. French officials were sent out to explain that Emmanuel Macron had wanted to stimulate debate and that ideas under discussion involved non-combat troops in roles such as demining, border protection, or training Ukrainian forces. Macron's comments also risk exacerbating tensions between France and Germany, whose relationship forms the core of European political cooperation. Emmanuel Macron appeared to goad Berlin over its initial reluctance to send offensive weapons to Ukraine, noting that some countries 2 years ago had only wanted to send sleeping bags and helmets. Behind the scenes, German officials have accused France in recent weeks of not sending enough military aid to Ukraine. A Western official said Emmanuel Macron had rattled some cages and provoked some head-scratching among NATO members. The official said the move could complicate US debate over a bill stuck in US Congress that would provide some $60 billion in aid to Ukraine if it stoked fears of an escalation in the war. A European Union diplomat said the result of Emmanuel Macron's comments was a cacophony between NATO allies at the expense of credibility. The Canadian broadcaster CBC News has also covered the same story. French President Emmanuel Macron's comments about sending ground troops into Ukraine triggered low-level panic among NATO allies. If it were any other time, and if the stakes weren't so high, the swift international slapdown that followed French President Emmanuel Macron's recent comments on Ukraine might have been funny. On Monday, 26th of February, Macron refused to rule out sending ground troops to Ukraine. The words were barely out of his mouth before startled allies and leaders around the globe started to wind them back, pour cold water on them, and even refute them outright. The speed with which nations lined up to have a crack at Emmanuel Macron was jaw-dropping. It was left to France's defense minister, Sébastien Lecornu, to reframe what his boss had said by referring to discussions among allies about sending soldiers to carry out demining operations and military training in Ukraine, well away from the front lines. "It's not sending troops to wage war against Russia," the French defense minister Sébastien Lecornu said, as if that would please Moscow any better. The idea of dispatching Western troops to Ukraine in any capacity has been unthinkable since the onset of major hostilities 2 years ago. NATO has made it quite clear it means to avoid being dragged into a wider war with nuclear-armed Russia. Emmanuel Macron's comments were interesting in part because he wasn't talking about an alliance-wide initiative, which would require consensus among all 31 members of NATO, but rather an individual bilateral initiative of the sort that's used to help train and arm Ukraine's military. But even so, Germany, Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and even the United States swiftly disavowed Emmanuel Macron's idea. Canada's response was a little muddled by comparison. Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland avoided directly refuting Macron's suggestion on Tuesday, 27th of February. It was left to a spokesperson for the Canadian Defence Minister, Bill Blair, to articulate the country's position. "We will continue to provide Ukraine with comprehensive military assistance, but as a NATO member, Canada has no plans to deploy combat troops to Ukraine."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, The Viewpoints. Here in the studio, I am with Brother Ali and Sheikh Agha Mohammadi, Islamic scholars and researchers. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, brother. Thanks for inviting me to this show.
Democratic countries, we see so much governments all around the country, all around the globe, and most of them are having some of them their own difficulties these days. They say that they have the support of people, but today, this is the question. And also we have some governments, some religious or Islamic governments all around the globe. Both claim that they're having their people support. They have, you know, people all around them. Here today, we're going to discuss these ideas. So I would like to ask my question from Brother Ali. Is this... You know, can you define the differences between these two types of governments, and which one has the right claim?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. To define these two types of governing system, I think it's not possible in this
period
of time. And to even talk about the characteristics of any of these two different systems of government. But we can just tackle and just look, a brief look at these two systems of government in brief. Democracy is a kind of government that actually takes its legitimacy from the people and from the votes of the people.
They claim that.
Yeah. So people actually are coming in the scene and they are selecting a group of people and they vote them and they select them as their leaders. And they are actually obliging themselves to obey those they have selected and elected through elections. But in an Islamic governing system, which is different, which is essentially different with this system, we believe that the government and this governing system has been taken from religion, from Islam. It comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. This is the creator that knows what kind of plan and programs are needed for these creatures, for his creatures on the scene of the earth. So one of the sources of, let's say, the source of legitimacy of the governing system in democracy is people. But what is it in Islamic government? It comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Does it mean that people have no vote, have no say in Islamic governing system? Definitely, people have their own place. The rights of the people, the votes of the people are seen in Islamic system. It doesn't mean that they are not going to be seen. The voices of the people are heard and seen quite clearly. But the legitimacy of it comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We believe that in the issue of legitimacy, there are some issues. The legitimacy of democracies is still under question. For example, are people able to write a program, a plan, I don't know, a comprehensive governing system for themselves while still they have some issues in understanding some of the basics? For a second, suppose that the people have selected and elected a group of, let's say, statesmen and a group of leaders for themselves. But what if we see that there are some conflicts in top with Allah's will or with Allah's orders and Allah's rules and obligations? So what is going to be the, how can we digest this then? But in the Islamic system, these are the people who come towards Imam or the leader of the society and actually welcome him and accept him as their Imam. I mean, look, people are selecting whom? Those who have been appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm. I mean, we have seen lots of prophets in the history, but the prophets, without the help and support of people, did not make any government. Let's look at Imam Ali alayhi salam's government. He was appointed, I mean, from the viewpoint of legitimacy, he was legitimated by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as the Imam and the successor of the Holy Prophet. But when people came and invited him to become the leader of the society, he finds his acceptability from the side of the people, not legitimacy. Legitimacy, or what we call it, mashru'iyah, comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Mm. So it means both are seen here in Islamic system. That is, in an Islamic system, we have the votes, the ideas, the views of the people parallel to the views and the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And one of the basic crises that actually exists in the system of democracy is the issue of legitimacy. Its legitimacy is under question. Mm-hmm. Because, with one simple example, I just want to invite my respected brother to shed some light on that. We see that, for example, a group of people, let's say 70, 50, 80, I don't know, percent of the people come and vote for their administration. Then how about the votes of the others? Let's say the other 30% who did not attend the elections. Mm. Are their votes are going to be seen or they are ignored? Suppose that in an election, as we see in the modern countries, that we see even the rate of participation in the elections goes to, for example, 40 or 50%. So then how about the rights of the others, other 60 or 50% who have not yet voted and who have not yet participated? So that's why we say that there is a problem or crisis inside the system of government in democracy. We don't want to say that democracy is against Islam, but we can perfect democracy with the system that we have introduced with an Islamic system. Mm-hmm. That is, in Islamic system, the votes of the people, the rights of the people are seen and valued 100%, not 70, 30, or 50%. 100%. And at the same time, the will of Allah is there.
So, okay. So we need to have both of them together. So I would like to ask your comments on this question. And what do you think?
As you said, talking about democracy, my brother very well elaborated that. Democracy means that people have right to decide for themselves. If you consider that definition, so we see that democracy and any other ruling is considering the issue of rights over about imposing somebody's will over others. So if it is so, the question is that who is going to give rights to people? You know, when you look at the Western and secular democracy, you ask them that when you're talking about the rights, that people have right to choose, people have right to decide, people have these rights that are the foundation, the cornerstone for democracy, where this right is coming from? A simple question is that, who said man has a right? So this is one of the fundamental philosophical questions for the law. They say what we have is social contract. So what, you ask the question, what should demand me, what should impose it upon me as an individual to give up and to accept the demand which is coming from somebody as authority? They say because there is a social contract, people have agreed to live in such a system. Why? Because this way most of your interests will be provided. If there is no system, then there will be chaos. In order to avoid it, to get the maximum happiness for maximum of people, then we will write a social contract. But underground, what happens is that the moment you have the money in your pocket and I have the gun in my hand, who is going to stop me from looting you? Nothing. So the problem is that when we are talking about the secular rights, that is, I said, the rights which are the foundation for democracy. When we are talking about rights, when we give rights to human, to people, without being connected to another source, this has no authority in itself. So the moment that they need, they can bypass the rights of others. Because when they talk about social contract, it's the value system that believes in the social Darwinism. In social Darwinism, what they say is that there is a pyramid. And anyone who is at the top of the pyramid has rights to do whatever they wish and will. You see, recently when this the storm of Al-Aqsa started in Palestine against Israel, what happened that Israelis declared that we are killing Palestinians because they are not human. They look like humans. They are animals. So you see that when it comes to the rights, what about the rights of people in Palestine? They have no right. Why? Because now it's my right. When it comes to my, as Israeli, we have power, we are at the top of the pyramid, so no right for the others. In order to dismiss them from the rights, they dismiss them from humanity. They say they are animals.
Yeah, we also can
So this is the problem with the system of rights, which is disconnected from another source. But in Islamic democracy, so we have different types of democracy. The one of them, if we accept it, and we call it Islamic democracy, it's a democracy. It's the right for people that this right is given to people from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it means that this is a gifted right. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in Quran says, لَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمَ. We have considered man dignitary. We have dignified man. We gave them honor. And nobody has this right to take away the honor from them. So the right as a human being is given to man by Allah, and nobody has such a right to take it from others. So originally the right to rule over people is for Allah. And Allah has given it to specific individuals to rule in a specific way. This way, there is no way just to bypass the rights of people. So we believe in the human rights, which is based on religion and observing the rights of Allah there, the real rights of man will be provided. So philosophically speaking, about philosophy of law, we believe that if the democracy is going to be rooted in the rights of Allah and by the authority coming from Allah, that will be a real democracy. But the democracy which is based on social contract, those who have power in their hand, they are likely to change the social contract anytime that it suits them. So there is no guarantee. And this is what, when it comes on the ground, I mean, forget about the theory. When it comes on the ground, when you look at the democracies, look at America, why people talk about we are 99%, means that we are ignored. In this liberal system, which calls itself democracy, as Malcolm X, rahmatullah alayhi, he said, there is no democracy. It is all hypocrisy. So democracy, which is based on religion, we can prove that, and we're talking about it, it will be real democracy.
Thank you. Well, well done. Thank you. Well said. And this is all the time we have. Have a nice time. Thank you for listening. Don't forget to tune in back next time. Bye-bye.
with a heart so full of love, and you show that you're the one who cares the most, and to us you've always been so close. Everyone will say, please save me, accept Al-Habib. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها لنا يوم القيامة. Ummati, Ummati, يقولها شفاعة أنا لها أنا لها.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The Limelight.
The Zionist regime genocide in Gaza will be remembered as the moral collapse of the West. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Palestine Chronicle wrote, "Now that some Western leaders have begun to feel increasingly uncomfortable as the enormity of the Gaza genocide unfolds, a few, though bashfully, are declaring that Netanyahu may be going too far. The Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza will be remembered as the moral collapse of the West. As soon as the Israeli regime war began following the Al-Aqsa flood operation on October 7th, every moral or legal frame of reference that Washington and its Western allies supposedly held dear was suddenly dropped. Western leaders rushed to Israel, one after the other, offering military, political, and intelligence support, along with a blank check to right-wing Zionist Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his generals to torment the Palestinians. The likes of the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, went as far as joining the Zionist regime's first War Council meeting so that he could take part in the discussion which directly resulted in the Gaza genocide. He said on October 12th, "I come before you not only as the United States Secretary of State, but also as a Jew. The interpretation of these words is disturbing, no matter how it is spun. But it also ultimately means that Blinken has lost all credibility as an American, as a politician, or even as a fair-minded human being. His boss, President Joe Biden, as if in an infinite loop, has been, for years, repeating that you don't have to be a Jewish to be a Zionist. Indeed, he has lived up to his maximum, declaring time and again, I am a Zionist. Indeed, he is. Like many other U.S. and Western officials and politicians, the United States president abandoned international and humanitarian laws altogether, even the law of his own country. The Leahy Law prohibits the U.S. Department of State and Department of Defense from providing military assistance to foreign security force units that violate human rights with impunity. Instead, he, like Blinken, subscribed to tribal affiliation and ideological notions, which simply added fuel to the fire. Though protected persons under international law, Palestinians seem dispensable, in fact, irrelevant to the point that their collective death appears critical for Israel to regain its deterrence and to protect itself, in the words of the Zionist regime's Minister of War, Yoav Gallant, against the human animals of Gaza. If there is a stronger word than hypocrisy, one would have used it, but for now, it would have to suffice. When the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, was asked point blank in an Al Jazeera interview on November 20 about the violations of international law in Gaza, he offered two completely different answers. I am not a lawyer, he said, when the legality of the Zionist regime's atrocities in Gaza were questioned. When the interviewer shifted to talk about Al-Aqsa flood, Borrell had no qualms about the issue. He said, yes, we consider that a war crime for killing civilians in this apparent way without any reason. This episode has not been repeated often in the US media simply because few mainstream media journalists are bothered or, more accurately, dare to question the Zionist regime's grisly behavior in the Gaza Strip. However, when such opportunities arose, the flagrant hypocrisy was impossible to hide. Marvel, for example, at Matthew Miller, spokesperson for the U.S. State Department, in response to rape allegations in both Gaza and Israel, when he was asked on February 18th about allegations of rape by the Zionist regime troops of Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip, his answer was that the U.S. has urged Israel to thoroughly and transparently investigate credible allegations. Compare this to his response to a question about unverifiable allegations of sexual assaults made by Palestinians against Israelis, although debunked even by the Zionist regime's own media. They have committed rape. We have no reason at all to doubt those reports, he said at a press conference on December 4th. Such examples are produced daily by hundreds of Western leaders, top officials, and media organizations. Even now, when the death toll has broken all records of brutality in recent human history, they still speak of the Zionist regime's right to defend itself, willfully ignoring the fact that the child killer regime of Israel has forfeited this right as soon as it engaged in this prolonged aggression starting in 1948. Indeed, international law on the rules of war and military occupation is situated within a framework notably laid out by the Fourth Geneva Convention that exists to defend the rights of the occupied, not the right of the occupier. This time-honored truth is obvious to the vast majority of humanity, save Washington and a few others, as dozens of envoys from around the world testified before the International Court of Justice from February 19th to 26th, protesting the Zionist regime's horrific violence, protracted occupation and racial system of apartheid. The United States sent its envoy to the highest court in the world to lobby for something else entirely. With the ironic title of acting legal advisor for the U.S. State Department, Richard Visick bizarrely urged the ICJ to ignore international law altogether. He said, "The court should not find that Israel is legally obligated to immediately and unconditionally withdraw from occupied territory." For far too long, but especially since October 7th, Western regimes, starting with the U.S. regime, have violated every last set of ethics, morality, and laws that they themselves developed, drafted, promoted, even imposed on the rest of the world for many decades. Currently, they are practically dismantling their own laws and the very ethical standards that led to their formation. Now that some Western leaders have begun to feel increasingly uncomfortable as the enormity of the Gaza genocide unfolds, a few, though bashfully, are declaring that Netanyahu may be going too far. Even so, not even an outright admission of responsibility would erase the fact that they are active participants in Netanyahu's killing campaign. When all is said and done, the blood of the horrifyingly high number of Palestinian victims will be shared equally between Tel Aviv, Brussels, London, Sydney, and all other genocide apologists. A crime of this magnitude will never be forgotten or forgiven.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.